a talk for this thing, Science and Engineering. I'm sure we can follow up with some questions at some point for those of you who want to go more deeply into some scientific aspects. Also, apologies to Jonathan, because I think it must be the third time he's heard this talk. There's always something new. You should never give the same talk. I'm sure you don't, Jonathan. So there's always something new. It's for you to find what is new. The last time Jonathan heard this, it was in Macedonia, I think. So I had to stop every other sentence to be translated into Macedonian. So it was twice as long as usual, the talk. So we've already had all of this. The only thing to point out is that this is our institute. I was the founding director of the Institute of Biomedical Engineering on the medical campus. It's a very interesting experiment because it's actually 110 when we moved in 2008, 250 when I stepped down a couple of years ago, researchers from the physical sciences embedded on a medical campus. So we have two half floors, first floor and then another half floor, below ground level, embedded within medical research institutes, two cancer research institutes and the Jenner Vaccine Institute, as well as the Department of Oncology. So it's very interesting to be an engineer out there amongst all these medics, and that's up in Headington, the Old Road campus. Any of you been to the Old Road Research Campus? Any medics here? One guy, two guys, three, four people. So that's up in Headington on the Old Road Research Campus. And this is an interesting view, is what it says, because I was an undergrad at Keble College, which is true, quite a long time ago. and it's the view from my office as head of department as well. Mm. So in 35 years, I've moved 150 yards, which is some form of progress. So just to tell you a little bit about the background as to why I may have some track record in these general areas. When I was appointed university lecturer in 1988, the first 10 years, my research was to do with designing very large-scale integrated circuits, where we were doing some very early ideas of adaptive circuitry that would mimic what is now known as machine learning. And some of our applications were path planning, localization of autonomous mobile robots. So we're one of the early teams working on the Mars rover project. But now one of my colleagues, who's junior in those days, and he's now a professor of information engineering, Professor Paul Newman, is the guy leading the autonomous vehicle projects in Oxford and in this country. And there will be autonomous spots, driverless vehicles, driving around Milton Keynes this time next year as a result of a project which he's leading. So that gives you some of the ideas how long it takes for research eventually to reach the application domain. This is research we were doing 25 years ago or so. And while he continued along that path, I moved in a slightly different way, still using machine learning, but applying this to the monitoring of safety critical systems. Two types of safety critical systems, jet engines and patients. So this is the Trent 500 engine, which powers the Airbus family of engines, the A350 mostly. But I worked mostly on the next engine, which was the Trent 900 for the Super Jumbo, and the Trent 1000 for the Boeing Dreamliner. So if any of you have been to Singapore or Australia on the Airbus A380, anybody in this room has flown on that? I have, to Australia. Oh, probably more. So there's about 10 of you who've been on the Airbus A380. About half the engines are Rolls-Royce engines, Trent 900. And if you've flown on a Trent 900 Airbus A380 combination, again, you will have flown on a plane with engines where the engine health monitoring unit was part of designing my research group. So a 15 to 20 year association with Rolls-Royce, and also working very much now with the local hospitals, both for critical monitoring in hospital, patient monitoring. The idea there is to detect deterioration as early as it occurs, because, and it's actually quite hard to prove this for reasons that I won't go into detail except in the Q&A, it's actually quite difficult to prove as a fundamental proposition that early intervention gives improved outcomes to the patients. But now there's the evidence building up that is the case. It sounds like common sense, and it is, but actually proving it in a proper fashion using a clinical trial protocol is actually quite hard to do. But we've been doing this for the last decade or so using some of our machine learning software to learn the characteristics of patients, and hence when they begin to deteriorate. And we've done that not just in critical care, but also out in the community for patients with chronic conditions such as diabetes or respiratory disease or heart failure and so on. So there's the idea of learning the patterns that correspond to normal physiology on an individual basis, and therefore being able to detect subtle departures from that to provide early warning. And all of that is machine learning, which is a particular form of artificial intelligence. But I meant to be talking to you about artificial intelligence, and that is, if you look carefully here, you see October 1950, published in Mind. So this is very relevant to people, to those of you who are maybe working in philosophy, certainly the philosophy of mind. And this is quite well known now because there's this well-known movie, The Imitation Game. Who's seen The Imitation Game? So again, it's roughly the same number of hands. I'm not sure if we've had a... who hasn't put their hand up yet? So I think you haven't, Rob. Go and see The Imitation Game with Benedict Cumberbatch, which is about the life of Alan Turing. And Alan Turing was a great mathematician, computer, not just a programmer, but a computer designer and philosopher. And he started thinking about, given the progress during the war, Second World War, and immediately afterwards, when would we reach a stage? So we're now talking 65 years ago about when we could actually deem a machine to be intelligent. And that's the well-known Turing test. And you've got it here, you would have read it by now. A machine may be deemed to be intelligent if it can act in such a manner that a human cannot distinguish the machine from another human merely by asking questions via mechanical links, using the kind of 1950s terminology. And of course it's about imitating human behaviour, hence the title of the film, The Imitation Game. When I first did this slide, my kids were early teens, and the craze then was MSN Messenger. Probably none of you remember, maybe Jonathan might just about remember MSN Messenger. And I used to use the illustration, if you're doing messaging a friend, of course it could be WhatsApp now, it could be just showing how up to date I am. My kids are now in their 20s, so I do know some of this. But if you're messaging somebody via WhatsApp, via Facebook, or anything else, and if you weren't aware, effectively, that the entity with which you communicated was not a human being, if it was a machine, then that machine could be deemed to have passed the Turing test. That's the kind of modern version of it. If the human observer is unable to distinguish between a machine and a human being, then in this form of communication, with them exchanging messages, without knowing who's at the other end asking the questions or indeed answering them, then that machine could be deemed to have passed the Turing test. And that 1950 paper is a very famous paper. It's meant to mark the beginning of artificial intelligence as a research topic. And of course, processing power per square millimeter of silicon grew in the 1960s, mostly as a result of the space program, because there was no way you could send astronauts with big thermionic valves to do the communications back to Houston. So transistor technology was developed, and digital computers started to become more and more sophisticated machines and started duplicating decision making capabilities of human experts, hence rule-based expert systems. And the most famous example of that is now nearly 20 years old. So 20 years ago, 18 years ago, so this month, that an IBM computer, and you see a human being there, that's simply because the human being had to make the moves that the computer was suggesting, took on Garry Kasparov, who was world champion at the time, and this is American dating, so this is the 11th of May 1997, and over a 5-game series, and beat Kasparov 3-2. So there we had a machine able to beat the most capable human being at what we would describe as a very sophisticated form of game playing, an intelligent task by most people's definition. So a chess playing machine is an example of an expert system, However, one of the reasons why this happened in 97 rather than 87 is not through any fundamental advances in AI, it's simply brute force. By the late 90s, computers were powerful enough, and of course they're even much faster now, especially if you use GPUs, as they're called, graphical processing units, 200 million positions per second. Actually, we could probably do about 1,000 times faster now. But by the late 90s, there was 200 million positions per second. And what it was doing is doing a tree search on all possible moves. So experts had built a score. If you had this kind of positions for white and these positions for black, you would have this particular score for white if you happened to be playing white. If you then move that pawn this way, would your score increase or decrease? So lots of games were scored like this and stored. And so the machine looked at every move, and if you move the pawn, then what about if you move the bishop this way on the second move, etc. And of course, that's actually quite a lot. It's what we call combinatorial explosion. Even a depth of 6 to 8 moves is a huge tree to explore. And so, for example, if after 2, 3, or 4 moves the score got more and more negative, then that search would be stopped. And so it didn't explore every possible move 6 to 8 moves ahead. But if it got better and better, sometimes the depth of the search went beyond 6 or 8, 20 moves. But it's a brute force approach. Based on the scores stored in the computer's memory, you literally go through every possibility and say, ah, I found the one which gives me the high score, therefore I'll move that piece because it's going to give me the better score. And that's not how we play chess. The machine intelligence, based on brute force, based on exploring all possible moves amongst the literally billions and billions of moves that could arise, 4 or 5 moves if I move this one here or that one there, etc. Brute force is not the way how we do it. I'm sure who is a chess player here who has played chess? Let's see if we get different sets of hands. So you've played chess, you have a spatial awareness, you don't compute literally in this kind of brute force fashion the way you're going to make the move. So it's interesting that a brute force way of actually trying to solve this task is much better than the best human being, but it does it in a kind of fairly simplistic brute force fashion. And so, despite these fantastic results, people started to think about the limitations of the Turing test. And one thing that it doesn't incorporate at all, which all of us as human beings do, is adapt and learn. And this corresponded really in the mid-80s to the start of really... There are multiple cycles, and I'll show you one more. This is part of the new stuff, Jonathan. There have been cycles roughly every 10 or 20 years, but the machine learning really took off in the mid-80s, although it actually had started in 1943, thinking about how the learning adaptation, the way that we human beings modify our behavior based on either reward or the opposite of reward, some form of punishment, is something that's not part of the Turing test, and yet most people would argue it's part of human intelligence. So you have two forms of learning where you give a number of examples. Supervised learning is, for example, face recognition would be to take pictures of all your faces and from a particular angle, that would be the training set, and if there are 50 people in this room, there would be 50 class labels because there will be one human being per class. Then the idea would be to show a different picture of one of the 50 of you, but taken, you know, wearing different clothes, different illumination, different angle, for example, to the camera. And would the computer have learnt sufficient features of facial recognition in order to be able to recognize the person and output the correct class? That would be an example of supervised learning having learned that problem. Unsupervised learning is different. You could still use the 50 faces and then to see whether there's a form of grouping that the computer could inherently learn. And that grouping may be different. For example, there's a grouping according to whether you wear glasses or not. So there might be a clustering, a grouping of the faces according to whether people wear glasses or not. It might be able to differentiate male to female differences. There are differences known to Renaissance painters, for example. I'm told that one of them is the distance between your nose and the middle of your eyes. The ratio of that distance to that is quite different in males and females. Somebody might actually tell me that that's not the case, but there are certain things that are known to trained painters that may be as a result of learning the fact that these ratios of facial features are different with males and females, you might be able to group them, and a computer might learn that without being told that this group is male and that group is female. It might learn to find distinguishing features between the two groups, and that's called clustering and unsupervised learning, because you're not told the answer a priori. Anyway, lots of applications. This is one I was involved in the mid-1990s, designed automated microbiome for Sharp, the company here, when they moved on to the Science Park, and it automatically recognized the food that you were putting in the oven to cook based on the amount of steam given off, different signatures by different types of food, and it stopped automatically at the right point. And it was the best-selling oven for Sharp in the mid-90s. This is the kind of, unfortunately, marketing material that you have to be subjected to if you get involved in a project like that, but it's all good, clean fun. A lot of you will know about automatic speech recognition, where, without getting into details, because that's at least half an hour to explain this slide, so I won't, you take a representation of the speech signal in the frequency domain, then you have some models for the speech sounds, and then how the sounds go together to form words, and language models is words forming sentences. You might have a training data corpus. It could be the last 10 years of the New York Times, for example. And you train on this to, you tell it what the word is based on the text that the person spoke. And then you switch off the learning, and then you let them go on new text and see how well they do. And we are really in words and even sentence and free text in the upper 90% nowadays. Especially since deep learning has come onto it. And the software, I don't know if any of you, I'm not going to ask you to put your hands up, have used automatic speech recognition software, but there's plenty of it about. And especially if you give it some time to train on your voice, it is incredibly accurate, close to 100% if you speak distinctly and you train it on your voice. Likewise, I mentioned face recognition before. These are some of the features, some of the distances you might look at: relative position, size or shape of landmarks, which are the eyes, the nose, the cheekbones, etc. And that allows you to recognize other images that you have of that particular person. And I've not used the app myself, but I'm told that Facebook, there's an app which allows you to recognize faces of people on Facebook. So this is not just in the research lab. This is actually present in everyday life, these forms of artificial intelligence based on machine learning. And one of the most recent developments of the last 5 to 10 years is what's called deep learning. And this is what people say will allow us to move closer to the original goal of artificial intelligence, sometimes called general artificial intelligence. And here, it's about learning the representations. So the way we constructed these networks of simple processing units, sometimes called neurons, tended to be in an ad hoc fashion. This is about actually trying to force them to learn different levels of representation. With, as you go deeper and deeper, hence the deep learning, you have higher levels of abstraction. Very simplistically, you would learn to letters before you would learn words, a little bit like what we've done in speech recognition, but you would actually try and learn some very simple categories first, and then having learned that, learn how to combine those to generate the words. And so we tried to do low-level categories, low-level representations initially, before combining these low-level representations to quite high-level categories. And there's some thought that this is the way the brain does it, because when I'm recognizing your face and so on, I'm looking at very simple features like edges, like shape, like texture of the face. That's what the visual cortex does at the low level. And then there are gradually higher and higher levels of abstraction to say, ah, this is Jonathan, somebody I've known for about decade or just under, and then you, at those higher levels of abstraction, you connect with the representation of that face and the, what it may, whatever it may mean to me. Likewise, if I look at somebody else who has got a particular type of features that may be similar to my genetic background and so on, then I would recognize a quite high level of abstraction. But in fact, in all cases, whether it's recognizing Jonathan that I know quite well, or one of you and having some high level thoughts about that person, the basic level of processing is exactly the same. And how do we actually then start making these abstractions as we go to high level processing is one of the interesting aspects of deep learning. And there's a very famous demonstration of how this works. This is the global president of Microsoft Research, and I've talked about face recognition, I've talked about speech recognition, there's also machine translation. And what happened at this conference, without telling the audience, he stood up a couple of years ago and started giving a presentation in English, and it was automatically translated into the English text on one side of what he was saying, but on the other side into Mandarin, all in real time, with about 90% accuracy. So there he was speaking, and you can see some of the Mandarin characters there. I think that's the conference here. This is before he starts, but you know, there were gasps of excitement in the audience as English text that was fairly well known, but after about 10 seconds the Mandarin started appearing on the other side. And since it was, as I say, a conference in China, this impressed the audience. And that was automatic real-time translation into quite a different language with different structures and so on. So, in the next 20 minutes or so, I'll now start, having introduced artificial intelligence and its current aspects, start to think about some of the more kind of ethical, possibly philosophical, possibly theological aspects of the question. And this is something that was very much prevalent about 10 years ago and so on, when a lot of people started writing about this. And it's to do with this, what appears to be a linear curve, but those of you who are scientists will have spotted that it's actually log linear, because this is factors of 10 as you go up from 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 and so on, and these are the years and so on. And you can see it's about 10 years ago, because it was in the days of Pentium 3 and 4 and about 2002-2003. And it's all to do with the fact that every time you increase the number of years, well, it varies slightly. It could be 18 months, it could be 2 years, computing power doubles. So from the time when I graduated from this university and so on, where there are about 10 or 100,000 transistors on a silicon chip, we're now actually at about, this has arrived slightly early, we're about 10 billion, and it's a doubling on a regular basis. And if you think of what you're able to do, there was this idea that simply because the silicon was getting more powerful, would end up with so many processing elements on the silicon chip, because we literally have, you know, of the order of a trillion neurons in our brains, and each one of them has 1,000 connections to another neuron, but we are beginning to approach a number of elements, computing elements, transistors, if you will, if you want to make that jump, around about 2030, 2040. Therefore, if you have as many processing elements on a piece of silicon as we have in our brains, will we not be able to have a brain-like machine in silicon? And of course, what most people will agree, although the definition of consciousness is what most of us will probably disagree with, but most people would agree that the most advanced property of a human being is consciousness. And if we believe that consciousness evolved over time, then the idea would be that in the same way as silicon has got more and more sophisticated, these silicon machines, then we would eventually see in about 20, 30 years from now, consciousness as one of the properties of the silicon chips, with these huge amounts, as I say, 100 billion, so 1 billion, a million, if you remember, is 10 to the 6, so that's 10 to the 9, and that's 10 to the 12, for those of you who know your powers of 10. And so is this idea that, and this is, you know, what we teach the undergraduates in electrical engineering in the second and third year, is that you can take a computer, a programmable intelligent computer, and you can keep going down to levels all the way down to a single electron. So I could actually give you a description. If I took the top off this, underneath the keyboard, there's some silicon chips. So that's around here. It's assemblies of logic gates. And I could actually follow the path of an electron in a transistor, which is then makes up some of these logic gates, which are assembled to give me the circuits in here. Then I can write a program that describes the electron flow through these gates, and I get up to a high-level language in a programmable intelligent computer. We can go up and down with absolutely no difficulties, no breaks at all, in the electrical engineering undergraduate course. So if I know something here, I can explain what happens there, vice versa, and up and down. And of course, you have an information flow from the path of a single electron to upwards to higher level and more sophisticated processing. And so what people tended to argue in these papers about 10 years ago is this is very simple, a single electron in itself. Transistor, maybe that's the level of a neuron. So this may be some kind of current here, electronic current. In the neuron, it will be ionic currents. And here's the intelligence of the human being and the intelligence of the machine. And therefore, if we got to that level of having the same order of processes on silicon machines as there are neurons in our brain, consciousness would emerge as a property at the highest level of the programmable electronic computer. An interesting thing about this is not an argument from electronic engineering. This is an argument actually from biology. And it's all to do with the fact that people in these universities, you know well, and others such as Richard Dawkins and so on, have made the reductionist approach from biology extremely popular, so that it wasn't just contained to evolutionary biology, but all the life sciences, and also spilling over into the physical sciences, and I include electronics as part of that. So you can have this similar model of a human being instead of a computer, all the way to the organism, starting with the genes, proteins, pathways, so through cells, tissues, organs. And it is certainly true that there's information flow from DNA to proteins. Some of the information encoded in the genetic code here, and there is an upward pathway through to higher levels. And of course, the fact that what happens here is entirely determined by what happens at this level, which is true in the electronic engineering perspective, is the view that somebody like Jacques Monod in France, Richard Dawkins, Francis Crick of Crick and Watson fame would have, that the genetic determinism, what happens here at the level of the whole human being, is entirely determined by the genetic program, and that is true for all living organisms. So you get in the book, one of the last books that he wrote before he died, Francis Crick, when he was in the States, which is The Astonishing Hypothesis, you, your joys, your sorrows, your memories, your ambitions, your sense of personal identity, free will, in fact, no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells, neurons, and their associated molecules. As Lewis Carroll's Alice, very appropriate here, just around the corner from Christchurch, might have phrased it, you're nothing but a pack of neurons. So you're entirely defined by what happens at the lowest level of this particular feed-forward architecture from genes upwards onto the complete human being. So that is still often seen as the prevalent view in biology. And in fact, interestingly enough, it's probably not the view that necessarily everybody who works in biology would have. About 10-15 years ago, a new discipline called systems biology began to emerge, and it is a challenge to the reductionist approach. So here you have reports from the Academy of Medical Sciences and the Royal Academy of Engineering on systems biology vision for engineering and medicine. And I sat on this particular commission representing the Royal Academy of Engineering, and the person who represented medicine and physiology was an emeritus professor, Dennis Noble, who's written a beautiful book, OUP 2006. Those of you who haven't read it, I thoroughly recommend it. The Music of Life, biology beyond the genome. And in that book, and in the work that, in fact, this is an illustration from that book, but in the, our report as well, it argues that this view, that the reductionist bottom-up view, is oversimplistic, because actually if you look at organisms, even fairly simple ones, never mind human beings, there are many levels of feedback. So your higher level feedback triggers a response at a low level. Here, a higher level triggers self-signaling. For example, even the mere fact of, say, having a shock to the heart would trigger different behavior in the cardiac cells. The protein machinery reads the genes. And of course, we now know that there are multiple effects at the level of the organism. For example, smoking has a huge effect on what happens at the level of gene expression. So it's an oversimplistic view, this view that there's only a bottom-up, feed-forward path in terms of the description human beings, or indeed other living beings. And the downward causation modifies the components in ways I've described, responsible for the upward causation, which in turn causes further feedback, etc. So it's much more complicated, what we call a nonlinear feedback system, and cannot simply be described what happens at the lowest level here, the genetic level. So the idea of genetic determinism is more or less dead, apart from a few diehard evolutionary biologists. And indeed, another challenge has been, why do we choose the genes at the lowest level? Completely arbitrary. If you're a quantum physicist, you're much more interested at a much lower level than that. So we can go below genes to molecules, below that to atoms, electrons, protons, subatomic particles, etc. So even the choice of genes is entirely arbitrary level, to call that the bottom-up level. So that's one challenge. A physicist who has actually come to talk to the Grand Christian Forum, I believe here in Oxford, from South Africa, the interaction of the bottom-up and top-down, and, you know, bottom-up and top-down, where is the bottom, where's the top, it's not entirely clear, but the interaction of going up and going down through these complex nonlinear feedback loops is what gives the emergence of true complexity, not arbitrary programming at an arbitrary level here, which is just big to be the genetic level. So the idea that just simply stacking large numbers of processors to 10 to the power of 12 together and having this kind of feed-forward path here with consciousness emerging at the top is an idea which has now been completely discredited, although it was quite prevalent about 10 years ago. So increasing the numbers of transistors will not lead to the emergence of consciousness at the highest level of the oversimplistic feed-forward architecture of the electronic computer, because the multi-level feedback loops and the complexity of living organisms is simply not captured and would be extremely difficult to capture, and there are arguments in Dennis Noble's book about this, in the design of electronic systems such as electronic machines such as computers. So it is very interesting to read in that book. Dennis Noble is, we call himself agnostic rather than believer, that the reductionist approach ignores the complexity associated with these multi-level nonlinear feedback loops and is a vastly oversimplistic interpretation of biological data. And just to quote Dennis Noble himself, the bottom-up reductionist approach, and this is a very important point, is not so much an interpretation of the biological data, but the reflection of pre-existing assumptions about how things are meant to be generally. So if you're a bottom-up reductionist, don't, you know, it is because that is your pre-existing assumption about how things ought to be. It's not the fact that, you know, it's the purest interpretation. It is not. It is a pre-existing assumption, just as much as somebody who's a believer and believes that God created us and the rest of creation with us. That is a pre-existing assumption, but so is the reductionist approach. It's not pure science, as argued by Wilkins and others. It is still based on a bunch of assumptions that they make about how things are meant to be. Therefore, statements such as "you are nothing but a pack of neurons" are themselves an interpretation of the data, looking at neural processing, based on pre-existing assumptions. Other interpretations are equally valid. What matters is for you to state what your pre-existing assumptions are as you look at the data. And of course, our prior assumptions, our prior belief is that we've been created in the image of God, who's beyond time and space. Very famous verse from the beginning of Genesis, in chapter 1, God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. And that is our pre-existing assumption, our prior belief, when we come to tackle these questions. And therefore, we take the way that neurons process information in a completely different way, although we look at the data in the same way as non-believing scientists would, and within the framework of analysing the data, arrive at similar conclusions. It's when you extend it to what it actually means in terms of our human identity that our paths must diverge. So, by faith, we understand the universe is not just confined to what we can see, and what we can see with our instruments is an extension of what we can see with our senses, because what is seen is not made out of what was visible. Therefore, there's a whole invisible world which can only be reached by faith that underpins the whole of the visible world. So those twin beliefs, which are core, I believe, to the core beliefs of the Christian faith, the belief that we've been created in the image of God, the belief that there's an invisible world beyond the visible that can't be accessible by our instruments but accessible by faith, those are core beliefs. They're not scientific statements. But the interesting thing is most scientists would now agree with Dennis Noble that we cannot say everything we want in scientific language. There are limits to the scientific discourse, and these two beliefs are beyond those limits. And very interestingly, Dennis Noble takes on Richard Dawkins in this, because the most famous book goes all the way back to selfish gene statement, and he believes that what Richard Dawkins would tell you here is completely pure statement of scientific facts is actually a non-scientific statement. So this famous extract from the selfish gene, now they swarm in huge colonies, safe inside gigantic lumbering robots, in other words us, sealed off from the outside world, communicating with it by tortuous indirect routes, manipulating it by remote control. I'll just do the final paragraph. They knew in me, they created us, body and mind, and their preservation, selfish gene, is the ultimate rationale for our existence. Here's a famous statement from the selfish gene. What Dennis Noble does, this is on the left-hand side of the page of the book, this is on the right-hand page, he has an alternative statement. Let's not worry about this one too much, but there in you and me, we have a system that allows their code to be read. Their preservation is totally dependent on the joy we experience in reproducing ourselves, our joy, not theirs. We're the ultimate rationale for their existence. Now, not quite maybe the statement that a Christian would make, but it is quite different from this one. And what he says to Richard Dawkins, and you know, their argument has continued beyond the pages of the book, is saying that actually there's no way you can design a scientific experiment to differentiate between the left-hand side and the right-hand side. There's no empirical data that you can acquire that would allow you to distinguish left from right. Therefore, since these statements cannot be based on empirical data and experiments that you would run, either to prove them or disprove them, they are non-scientific statements. Therefore, these statements made by Richard Dawkins are non-scientific statements. And that is very important. And the way to test whether it's scientific or non-scientific, Dennis Noble proposes, is to be able to rewrite it in a different way, different perspective, and say, give me the experiment now, give me the empirical data that I could collect in order to differentiate between this and that. If you can't, it's a non-scientific statement. I think that's very important to take with us when we have discussions with people who believe in the reductionist approach, the selfish gene type arguments put forward by Dawkins and others. One more thing, and this is quite new, so you've not heard this before either, Jonathan, The debate has somehow moved on in a leap caused by a number of people, including Stephen Hawking. And of course, it's very interesting, there was a film about with Benedict Cumberbatch as the lead actor, about Turing. There's a film about Hawking with Eddie Redmayne as playing Stephen Hawking, and of course he won the actor for won the Oscar for Best Actor. It's almost as though what artificial intelligence mean or doesn't mean, that debate is still going on, but these people want to take it further and say, we will at some stage, even if we're not here, we will get full artificial intelligence. What will it mean for us? And so Stephen Hawking came out with a statement that development of full artificial intelligence could mean it's the end of the human race, because if we create machines that are beyond human beings, that are able to self-replicate in a way that we cannot control as human beings, and they can do it much faster than we can, because we're hampered by the fact that biological evolution is rather slow, we would be superseded, and it would have potentially very negative effects for the human race. And you may remember this was picked up by the popular press. Bill Gates said he agreed, we should be worried about the threat posed by artificial intelligence. I don't understand why people are not troubled by the possibility that AI could grow too strong for people to control. So the debate is moving on. What happens if we create these super intelligent machines? And not because I was looking for it, but you'll find out why this is. There is a pastor in Florida who has actually become quite famous, apparently in the US, and there may be some of you in the US here, in terms of talking about these issues. There's a whole website that you can look at, Reverend Dr. Christopher Benyick, and he believes that advanced forms of artificial intelligence should be welcomed into the Christian faith. And in italics, again, these are statements that he's made. I don't see Christ's redemption limited to human beings. It's redemption to all of creation, even artificial intelligence. And if AI is autonomous, then we should encourage it to participate in Christ's redemptive purposes in the world. Now, I'm not going to give you my view on this, because it's very new, and you may want to have a discussion about it that we can have. But I didn't know about this guy until I was invited at 2 days' notice in late March to take part in a program. Some of you may have heard on BBC Radio 4 called Beyond Belief. It was transmitted on Easter Monday. They deliberately kept it back for Easter Monday, 6th of April. And I discussed the promise and threats of artificial intelligence with Anders Sandberg, who's actually a philosopher here in Oxford, Elaine Graham from Chester University in the canon Chester Cathedral, and myself. And if you want to follow it up, all you have to do is Google BBC Radio 4 Beyond Belief, Artificial Intelligence, you'll find it, or you can find it there. As I say, I'm not going to go through, because we're getting close to the end of my 45 minutes anyway, but three points that I thought were important that emerged in discussion. And by the way, in the middle of it, completely unprepared, they played us a tape of one of Benek's not sermons, but his stuff about artificial intelligence, so we had to react to it in real time, which is quite interesting. I think it's going to be important, as we develop more and more intelligent machines, to rethink the Turing test in terms of a different way, informed consent. So if you book your theatre tickets or your cinema tickets, you'll be doing it with a machine, not a human being. And you're usually aware that you do so. But I think if there's an interaction with a machine and you don't know it's a human being, and you may well think it is a human being, actually, I think that we should let people know when it's not obvious that they are, that they're actually interacting with a machine rather than a human being. So actually give consent to this interaction, so it's a kind of slightly new version of the Turing test. In terms of what we do machines, and in terms of their ability to self-adapt and so on, I think there will be there's an as with missing there off the edge, has been cropped off. The time will come in about 10, 15, 20 years where we ought to think in the same way as we have with in vitro fertilization. What are the ethical boundaries? What ought to be the limits about what we do with these super intelligent machines. And of course, the whole challenge is, what is different about these machines, which would be built mostly out of silicon or optical components, compared to us, who we believe have been created in the image of God. So that's very new. It's only the last couple of months or so. Just throwing some points out there, possibly for discussion. And of course, it's very much developing in terms of interaction. And the three-person interaction, Anders and Elaine were in the studio in Salford, where the BBC is based now. I didn't have the time at 2 days' notice to take a day off to travel to Manchester back, but I did it from the studio in Radio Oxford. And actually, if you listen to the programme, you cannot even perceive that I was 150 miles away from the other participants in the programme, which of itself is interesting. Conclusion. So four conclusions, just to throw in to summarise in my last couple of minutes. It is interesting that we have artificial intelligence without a shadow of doubt. You know, if you've got a car, the ignition system will be constructed there'll be a microprocessor there using artificial intelligence to optimise the time at which the spark occurs when you have electronically controlled ignition. When you make your next mobile phone call, it could be to somebody in another college, it'll probably be routed through half a dozen cells all over the country. There's an artificial intelligence piece of software that will do that optimally, given the occupancy of all those cells by other people making calls. So every time you use your mobile phone, you're using indirectly software which is highly intelligent. Chess playing machines, ubiquitous, they're better than the best human being on the planet playing chess. But interestingly, they do not play chess, they do not recognize speech or faces in the machine the way that we do. What is different about the way that we solve these hard problems to the way the machine does it? But still in chess playing is the brute force approach that the machine takes. This is now becoming something of the past. This argument that simply by stacking the same number of processors as we have processors in our brains, called neurons, we will arrive at an intelligent machine, and the ultimate form of that intelligence is consciousness. That's been debunked a number of times now. And the interesting thing about that, it emerged because of the influence of bottom-up reductionism on fields outside of biology. Its prevalence is greater than its real influence amongst the scientific world. That's the problem with a lot of myths. One of the myths is that you come to Oxford to study arts and humanities, you go to Cambridge to do science and engineering. The results in science and engineering in Oxford and medicine were far better than Cambridge in the last research assessment exercise, the REF. That is a myth. You know, Oxford is behind Cambridge in science and engineering. It's not. The best research in science and engineering is done in Oxford rather than in Cambridge. It is a myth that will take another 15, 20 years to die. Some of us are working quite hard on trying to kill off that myth. But the myth of the bottom-up reductionist is the scientific worldview is exactly a myth. But it'll take another 10, 15 years before it's completely eradicated, or at least its limits are perceived. But I think it is very important that we as Christians should take on some of the non-scientific statements that are made. You are nothing but a pack of neurons. We should challenge and take them up. They are non-scientific statements. They're not pure science as we are led to believe. They're based on the prior beliefs of the people that make those statements. And we should really challenge that in the way that Dennis Noble, who's agnostic, rather atheist, has challenged them, and indeed has taken a lot of criticism, and some quite severe criticism and quite appalling stuff on his website at times, because you know, people do not like these beliefs to be challenged. And finally, as I mentioned, we're now starting to think that we will have some form of super intelligent machines. Let's not worry about whether I mean or not. They're going to be here in 15, 20, 30 years' time. We have to start to think about the ethical assumptions. So the ethical issues that these assumptions raise. So again, as Christians, we shouldn't put our heads in the sand, even though I have lots of reservations about the assumptions that are being made by the people that believe that we're going to have these super intelligent machines and what the machines will actually do. we do need to take part in the debate, and it is very important in both of these cases that graduates who are undertaking research in these domains or just outside take part in the discourse and the debate. It's very important that the Christian voice is heard, and that's why I hope that you find this talk tonight interesting. Thank you very much.
Like me to deal a Q&A for you?
Yep, I mean, yeah, well, if it comes, happy to do it. Yeah, should I switch the projector off, or maybe
sure,
I'll leave it just in case we go back to one or two slides later.
Okay,
say
sure.
People might have questions about it. Are you happy with those as background, are you?
Yeah, thank you for your talk. Any questions, I'll put out to you first.
Give a bit of time to think. There's one there, there's one there. Start with that.
I was wondering, so I'm not in the field of artificial intelligence. When people like Bill Gates and when they talk about the fear of super intelligence, where did it come from? I mean, did it have a basis? Because it seems to me there is no scientific basis of this super intelligence. So why are they afraid? I was just wondering.
And they're afraid of the decisions that they would make. Anders Lindbergh, who was the other guy participating in the debate Beyond Belief on the radio, he said quite clearly in the debate that he was an atheist. But actually, very nice guy to debate with, really enjoyed the conversation. And I must meet up with him at some point. He gave a very good example. He said, think of the super intelligent toaster. Okay? So when we design machines, we try to maximize what's called an objective function. So all of learning is about maximizing an objective function. Are you a scientist?
Yeah.
Okay, so we're maximizing an objective function. For example, in recognizing faces, we minimize the recognition error when you show new faces to the machine. And he said, what you're trying to do with what is the toaster is trying to maximize is the fact that all the bread in the house should be toasted. That's how, you know, if it's designed to maximize that function, you should have all the bread toasted as efficiently as possible. Well, there's a good way of doing that. Burn the house down. Okay? So if you're maximizing the objective function simply of having all the bread, you know, reduced to cinder, which is effectively what a toaster does, if taken to its ultimate conclusion, then actually burning the house down is what this machine will do. And I thought that was a great illustration. Philosophers come up with some good stuff occasionally. A great illustration. It is the worry that if you design these machines to maximize objective functions, because they don't have a sense of morality, of what impact burning a house down, if you're just interested in having, you know, the bread turned to some burnt molecules, it doesn't matter if the furniture is burnt, if the human beings are burnt. So, you know, these machines, if they just have some clear goals to maximize subjective functions and they have no sense of what we perceive as human beings to be moral or ethical issues, they could make entirely the wrong decisions. That was the example. And that's what Bill Gates says. And especially if they then go on to design themselves without any human intervention for the machines, then those machines may be even worse in terms of what they actually do as part of maximizing a particular objective function. So that's the worry, because those super intelligent machines will just have the goal of maximizing whatever objective function is part of their design, and they will not worry about the consequences, indirect consequences of doing that. That's one example of the fear. There was one there before, sir.
I'm trying to think which question I want to ask. I suppose one is when you're talking about the IBM Deep Blue match, my understanding was that computers had moved beyond brute force and that they were now using sophisticated inference, basically constructing essentially a Bayesian inference process. So, for example, in the beginning of a chess game, the pieces are lined up in a very like order in a predetermined way. So if you go to, say, six or seven loops, there are only a small finite number of combinations in something that the computer can brute force the beginning of the game. And at the end of the game, when you only have eight pieces left, four on each side, say, there's so few pieces, even though the whole board is open and the starting position is random, it can still brute force it. But in the middle, there are still so many exponential possibilities that the computer cannot brute force it. That was my understanding, and so that it used some sort of statistical inference-based, probability-based...
not in Deep Blue. I mean, the Bayesian inference, the probability-based... has developed a lot in the last 20 years, and we use some of that software ourselves. I don't know if it's been applied to chess playing machines, it's not my field, but certainly Deep Blue was based on brute force in opening gambits, brute force in middle game, brute force in end games. And you're right, the level of complexity does change as you get closer to the end game, and the level of randomness is different. I don't think those concepts were programmed into the machine. But it is interesting that there are two schools. There's the kind of probabilistic Bayesian inference, and there's the deep learning again, which doesn't use these. And they constantly this split in the history of machine learning between kind of mathematical, statistical. Not that deep learning isn't underpinned by sound mathematical principles, but it is trying to understand why, you know, these representations. A lot of it is very good for visual tasks, and they have intermediate representations, and we don't fully understand that through setting a particular objective function we end up with very interesting representation. And if you have to be very careful, because you just slide the camera sideways by a small amount, it can completely destroy your internal representation unless you build translation invariance. That's why they have convolution networks within that. So it's about, it's not quite the same mathematical framework as probabilistic inference. It is about representations and how to combine them to get the right answer. And then the brute force artificial intelligence was more like expert-based systems. So you've already got three different schools of artificial intelligence with some overlaps, but they are quite different schools, and they solve problems differently. And interestingly, depending on the task, I've got different levels of success. And there's no grand unified theory of artificial intelligence, although people believe that deep learning one day will allow us to get to that grand unified theory of general artificial intelligence. So it's a fascinating area to work in, and Bill Gates himself in that interview in January 2015 said, if I hadn't set up Microsoft, I would love to be an AI researcher. It's the most interesting subject. It is, as I say, it still does have these various schools. Talk to each other, but there's no grand unified theory, and you can apply different approaches to different tasks with varying degrees of success. It's a very interesting research field, I don't know, are you in one of the departments here doing that kind of work?
I work in physical chemistry.
Right.
So we use computers on computer
science. Right. Well, deep learning has had some extraordinary successes, I'm told, very recently in terms of, you know, protein sequences and so on. And again, nobody quite understands why. It seems to do very well in high-dimensional problems such as those. Nobody quite understands what representation is for, but there are some, as I'm sure you know, some data sets that are standard, and you can try different approaches. And it's a very recent result that deep learning has had some quite amazing success in that particular field. So...
Yeah, thanks. Sorry, first of all, sorry for being late. So my questions to do with you all are first to point out informed consent, limits, and boundaries. And I think the area where I kind of increasingly have concerns is around the nexus between artificial intelligence, big business, and big data, which none of these things are things I work on or think about in much detail. But a friend of mine who's a neuroscientist has background in mathematics, has been employed by a company in the US who wants to provide credit in emerging economies. Mm-hmm. And so he has data, significant amount of data from the Nigerian government, largely on people's phone records. And so yeah. He's in the process of developing algorithms, I can't say that word now,
to
interpret that data to be able to then decipher who will have the lowest risk to be able to provide credit. So I've had a long conversation with him with all the multiple concerns I have. But for that for me kind of brought some of my concerns to a very concrete case that he's working on. Because my understanding of it is that it will determine X, Y, or Z person would be a good person to give credit to. But that could have implications for gender, class, ethnicity, but it can't. When I asked him if he could qualify on what basis it was distinguishing this data, he seemed to not be able to tell me that in a concrete way. So my question is, how do we, especially if it seems to me this a concern around expert knowledge, that it, as a just an average lay person who's not has any scientific training, it feels very hard for me to participate in a conversation and feel like I know the right questions to ask one. And so it's a question around what types of regulatory systems do you think we need in place, and how do we kind of democratize somehow what's actually going on that's not just in the scientific community but also increasingly in the business community, and what are some of the things that are actually already happening to prevent what could be destructive in various ways, and what do we need more of in that way?
Well, we need more people who work in those fields to be aware of the ethical dimensions, including the person you're talking to. I mean, it is very interesting. I went to see, when was it, just before Easter, the play Oppenheimer, which is about the father of the hydrogen bomb. And it's about what the scientists who worked together before the bomb was tested in Los Alamos and then in Nagasaki and Hiroshima and so on. Huge ethical questions, pretty obvious there, but they're exactly the same questions, as you say, about the use of data. So we can track, from mobile phone records, the spread of malaria much quicker than we could before and intervene to save people's lives. Likewise, I can't remember which typhoon it was. I don't know what's happened in Nepal in terms of mobile phone records, but one of the typhoons recently, the devastation was a lot less than it was before, because again, the way we tracked the mobile phone conversations, etc., the way that they cluster set. So there's a lot of potential for using this for human good, but there's also lots of potential for using it. So the ethical questions are the same. Whether it's nuclear fusion, could be a clean source of energy 20, 30 years away, could blow the planet away if several hydrogen bombs were released at the same time. So in every field, these questions around the use of big data is another one. The problem is IVF, of course, another one. Three parent babies. So how do we make decisions whether it is right to have three people involved in bringing a baby into the world? Apparently with sort of equal rights to be that baby's parent. So all of these questions have huge ethical dimensions. I think for me the difficulty is twofold. The complexity, as you say, explaining to a lay audience what they are, and maybe the lack of people, Christian faith, on wanting to engage with the ethical question, because it is quite hard in many ways to raise the ethical flag until you're quite a senior person, because if you ask to run a program that allows you to do credit rating, and that's been done before, how do you go to your boss and say, well, I've written this piece of software and I think it really works based on the data you gave me, 10,000 transactions, I've written the software and I can predict quite well who are the high risks based on 10,000 transactions I've never seen before, all the transactions of 10,000 people. As to whether this is morally right to do or not, it's very hard when you're a graduate student or the next level up. But I think it is very important to do so. And part of the problem with big data, part of the problem with, say, deep learning, you put your finger exactly on it, it's very difficult to have a degree of explanation as to why the machine is coming up with this particular credit rating. So expert system, you could say, if the person is less than 25 and they've got a mobile phone which is only, it's not on a contract, but it's on paper use or etc., and they haven't made a purchase of £100 for 6 months, etc., then their credit rating ought to be C on the A to E. Then you can understand that's an expert system. But the system, but the machines now don't do. They combine all the data and they come up with an answer between A and F, and you don't know why it is that they've come up with that. So the lack of explanation is a worrying phenomenon, because if you want to object to the fact you've been given credit rating F as opposed to A or B, then it's very difficult, because why would you object? The machine has come up with this, and all they can say is based on the experience of similar people to you that we've arrived at this particular, and how can you argue otherwise? And so part of the problem with the current artificial intelligence is a lack of explanation for the machine's decisions. Mm-hmm. What we can do is get you guys doing your DFILs, get in depth into all these areas, and never lose sight of the ethical dimensions of the challenges, and be willing to explain them, you know, over a pint of beer or dinner and so on, to other people, as obviously your friend has done, because you had a very good grasp of the issues. And then the more difficult bit after that is the whistleblowing.
We have another one. I had a question about your second conclusion, which I think was...
We can put it up simply.
...related to just because you get more kind of transistors per square inch of silicon or whatever doesn't mean their consciousness. But, presumably, if you have enough transistors and you can also get the architecture so that you have some kind of top-down causation feedback mechanisms working as well, then perhaps you could, you know, so long as you're a physicalist about philosophy of mind of some species, then it is plausible to build something that...
So do you mind if I ask you what your subject is? Because there are different answers depending on what the subject is.
Theology.
Theology? Oh, right. Okay, that's fine. My son has just finished his DPhil in theology. Some of my best friends, some of my family are theologians. Read The Music of Life. I thoroughly recommend it. Dennis Noble has an argument for that, when he says that even if you manage to build the most sophisticated computer incorporating all the physical principles, all the connections, including the feedback connections and so on, and set it off to compute, it would take longer than we have since the beginning of creation, as estimated by best scientists at the moment, how many billion years it is, for a computer with using particles of sands as the computing processors to be able to compute at the level with the level of complexity that encapsulated all the complexity from the genetic level upwards. So he teases that, that's a slight oversimplification, but he teases it this way. If you'd been an engineer, I would have said to you, the loops are nonlinear feedback loops, and that's incredibly, you only have to have two simple nonlinear feedback loops, and it becomes incredibly complicated to compute. So even from physical principles, it can be argued that actually, if you don't just have a simple feedforward architecture, it becomes very quickly impossible to have the ability to compute with all these complexities built into the computing machine. So I hope that satisfactorily answered multiple levels. Somebody must have an energy barrier over there, nodded when I mentioned nonlinear feedback. So what's your subject?
I'm in chemistry as well. As soon as I had nonlinear, I knew.
Yeah, that's right. That makes things much more complicated. Engineers, we spend our lives linearizing, which is taking a nonlinear part of the curve and taking such a small bit of it that we can actually then use linear approximations. I'm sure chemists do that a lot of the time as well. Nonlinear is complex.
Well, actually, I have three questions. The first is you said AI is maybe dangerous to human beings, right? And I want to ask, is it possible to formalize our human beings' concept, moral concepts, and programming into the machine or computing something? And can
let you it think behave. It's possible to formalize?
Is it possible let it behave properly, or you can maybe the AI is based on the machine learning, right? So maybe the machine can learn from our big data, the big data of our human beings' everyday life, and learn from what is proper behavior every day, and learn from them when the machine is doing decisions, and they know what is proper way to do it. Is it possible? That's the first question. The second question is that...
Well, just to stop there, because otherwise I probably, my brain capacity isn't enough probably to remember the complexities of just your three questions. Think of the toaster. How will you program the fact that, you know, just burning the bread isn't the main function? So how would you program into the toaster an awareness of what else goes on into that house? You know, somebody's got the answer behind.
Well, I was just going to see if I could comment on that, but I mean...
I haven't forgotten your other two questions about this. It's good to get a discussion going.
You probably could program, you know, don't burn house, or like don't burn, you know, cabinets, don't burn, you know, and then just sort of list things, but I think that the problem is probably an epistemic problem.
I think
the limitations of the programmer at that point in time, right? And so there's so many things that we sort of don't see at the moment, so there's kind of a short-sightedness that, you know, someone in that situation would, you know the answer to. But the computer programmer programming the toaster, you know, won't be able to. So they might, you know, program, say, like, you know, 100 items in a household, but then, you know, a year later there are new items in someone's house that they just didn't know about, right? So it seems like that, this sort of human knowledge, there's kind of an epistemic dimension to that problem.
It's not just that. I love the toaster example because, it, to me, as a simple engineer, it sort of makes sense. It's the indirect consequences. You know, what are the moral implications of making toast? How would you program that into? Because I've given a simple illustration, we thought of a few rules. But how would you actually go beyond the few simples? And as you say, when confronted with one that you hadn't been programmed with, how would you know the machine would make the right, you know, the probability would be half that it would make the right decision or not if it's something that it had not seen before, unless you're able to somehow encapsulate the behavior so that in terms of mathematical terms what you were doing is interpolation, so guessing between two known behaviors rather than extrapolation going beyond. And you know, this moral sense that children have, even of something being wrong or right, how do you actually put that into a toaster, as well as getting it to toast bread efficiently? Obviously, that's a very big discussion, and Rob will want to come with that. But we better have your two other questions before we go back to the moral toaster. So, your next two questions.
The next question is that. The machine can do lots of things that use a different kind of weight from human beings. So if human being has emotion, what's the emotion in AI? Is it possible to have emotion? And the third one is, most of the machine learning is based on big data. Nowadays, lots of these databases are controlling big companies like Facebook or something else. If they don't share the big database, how can we get this data and let the machine learn and be powerful?
Data sharing, data privacy is a huge issue. Different companies take different attitudes. I'll try and answer that and again, that of itself is one question which was hinted at by the question from the front. So even actually having the data. So I do quite a lot on, as I say, smartphones for healthcare, with Apple and Google. We've done an app with Stanford, which is actually on the iTunes, and it uses the new health kit that Apple has released, and it involves, it's called My Heart Counts. It's actually an app for people who suffer from heart failure or at risk of heart failure or cardiovascular disease. And so it's, you know, all its aims are entirely worthy and so on, and it's basically things like trying to capture your physiology during a 6-minute walk test. Simplest way I can put it. That data then is captured through accelerometers, through step counts, so on your phone, and it exists on the phone for a short period of time, and then it gets transmitted to the cloud. Apple do not want the data to exist on the phone for more than a few seconds, if at all, and then it gets sent off to the cloud to be processed by another company. Google takes completely the other way in view. It thinks having this data from multiple people doing a 6-minute walk test will be wonderful. and we could then do deep learning and, you know, for the benefit of mankind, discover lots of things that may help people manage their cardiovascular disease better. So the two biggest giants in this field take a completely different view to data. Apple doesn't want to have anything to do with it. It just uses the phone as a capture mechanism of the data. It's resident on the phone for a short time. It's got to go as quickly as possible to a different storage location on the cloud, a virtual storage location on the cloud. Google takes the opposite. They want to know in an anonymized format the data. So even the two biggest companies in the world I'm looking at this have a completely different view of data. And even between human beings, the way we view data is completely different. I was actually amazed that in Japan, for example, your GPS data is available to everybody. Parents track where their children are by the GPS data from their phone. And anybody in the country from, you know, big businesses on, has got access to, they don't mind Japan sharing their location data with everybody. As I said, that's how parents keep track of their kids. You know, if you ask in this country or the US, people say, look, we're going to know at every point where you are, because when your phone will be switched on, there'll be huge problems. So even there, between two different sets of human beings on the planet Earth, there are different interpretation of what privacy and data mean. So it's a hugely complex issue. So even between human beings, if we have a different view of data, how do we then capture that and put it into a computer that you'd be happy to use in Japan or in the US or in the UK? So it's an ethical, much more than a programming question at this stage. And in terms of emotions, I mean, again, what are emotions? The ability to draw a little smiley face. Well, my computer can put a smiley face. And you have these, you can look at them on YouTube, these videos of people interacting with computers, and they give the computer a smiley face, and you can shake the hand and so on. I mean, do you really believe that's another human being you're shaking the hand off? Even though they've put two eyes and a smiley face. And even this film, I didn't actually see it because I didn't want to get too worked up about it. What was it called? This film that came out at the end of last year. About this female actress plays a robot. What was it called? Her, that was 18 months ago.
Is it Lucy?
It wasn't Lucy, it was...
Ex Machina.
That's the one, Ex Machina. Did you go and see that?
I haven't seen it. It's coming out. I thought, actually,
it hasn't come out yet. Maybe it's just the trailer that I saw. Has it come out?
I've been trying to get hold of it, but it's really hard.
I don't think it's been streamed on a net yet. But, not available on Netflix, but it probably was at the... I think it was at the cinema, wasn't it, Ex Machina? But I was concentrated on the Deus one, the Ex Machina, because it was around about Easter. All of these things, and I think it's something that people are very interested in conceptually. Can we create a machine that has all the aspects of a human being? I would turn the question around, is, you know, what is it that makes us uniquely human? And that's something that philosophers and theologians have been thinking about for a long time, and therefore we should talk to them, rather than thinking about what the computing aspects of that question are, which I'm sure where Rob wants to come in.
I had just a sort of nitpicking comment about toast.
Yeah.
But there's such a thing as burnt toast. So I guess I wasn't really sure that it was a good illustration, in the sense that ideally toasted bread is sort of just browned, just crisp, but not burnt. So would the best toaster sort of toast the whole house, or apply just enough heat to get toast,
all the bread, tan.
You know, tan. Yeah. Yeah, but maybe a blender would be a better example. It's sort of, a good blender obliterates sort of milk and fruit and everything you throw in, the ice you throw in it. And would a good blender then sort of try to obliterate the whole?
I'll mention it to Anders next time I see him. Forget about your toast analogy. Use the blender analogy.
Just a question to follow up on that. How are you distinguishing super intelligence, like a super intelligent toaster or blender or whatever, from consciousness? I mean, I guess those are distinct things, because a conscious toaster could also question its programming and try to strike out into something, some kind of new objective, I guess.
Well, I mean, this is where we get in the realm of what the terms actually mean. I just use the terms that people are using at the moment, but you're absolutely right. You know, and Rob is right to nitpick that. It's by way of illustration, obviously. that those two examples, I guess, it has many limitations. What's the difference between a conscious machine and a super intelligent machine? You know, I think that one of the problems is that a lot of the people who use those terms use them very loosely.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of it is all about definitions. And I don't know what the difference is, because they've not even defined what a super intelligent machine is. I think one definition I've seen is that it's the ability to self-replicate, but self-replicate with changes that the machine has decided to make.
Mm.
So is that consciousness, is that superintelligence? Very difficult to know. But it's the ability to design another set of machines yourself, because you know, you've been programmed to design other machines. But the key thing is that you become superintelligent because you acquire the ability to introduce changes in the next generation of machines, which will make them even more intelligent than you are.
Right.
But will they ask themselves, why am I introducing? You see, the key thing is, if at the next generation, as you go from N plus one, machines are able to introduce differences, what will be the motivation? Well, you could say, I want you to design a better machine, more efficient. I can see that's clear, but why would they be programmed to create something that was different in a way? What would be the objective function in some ways? So there's always an objective function in any piece of software that you write. So what is the objective function? Why would the machine question the person that designed it? Is that consciousness? Maybe yes, it's consciousness. We ask why we're here, why we're creating in a particular way. It's difficult to see how this non-linearity, this ability to question why you've been designed a particular way, could actually be programmed into a machine. But maybe people believe that they are. Is that consciousness? Is that super intelligence? It's all a matter of definitions.
Mm-hmm.
I can't see, personally, in terms of having worked in artificial intelligence for about 20 years, any way that you could design a machine that would do that without you explicitly introducing this element into the machine. This step of the machine itself being able to do, I think, be able to do it without having been programmed to do it, I think is still the realm of science fiction. There's no scientific result that would even hint at that being possible.
Has there been a theory to replace the one that you said 10 years ago, the bottom-up kind of a thing that was quite popular at the time? Is there anything kind of coming up, a model that would explain how development of consciousness might?
I mean, there may well be, because I've got a day job, so I don't have time to read. And there's a lot of stuff on the internet about this. You could spend most of your week doing it. So there may well be. I don't know of any that's sort of creditable in the literature. People are thinking about quantum computers, the fact that multiple possibilities can exist within quantum computing, and how you choose the optimal possibility as an infinite set of possibilities, and whether at some point the one that is chosen will be independent of the way the machine has been set up. That's one that I can think of, but there may well be others.
I think Carl had another question.
A question. What do you think about the frame problem, and is that sort of, how does that fit into this discussion? And the reason I asked that question...
Well, you have to remind me what it is. I'm sure I've read about it a while ago, but I have to be perfectly honest with you.
What?
I can't...
So it's been a while for me as well since I've read some of this stuff, but I remember those who sort of, philosophers who challenge the idea of AI, pointed out that there's the problem of sort of analyzing the environment, and that basically the human sort of body and, you know, the emotion and sort of kind of the perception we have, it allows us to sort of, makes the phenomenology of perception, allows us to sort of move through the environment seamlessly, kind of understand the way we have goals, sort of project ourselves towards those goals, and then try to attain them, and this sort of thing. It's just sort of innately the way we are. We have this ability, whereas a robot has to sort of take all, absolutely everything at face value and sort of analyze, do this like brute work that you explained, but
So it's not a chess game, it's like life, which would mean analyzing all sorts of irrelevant things that a human being wouldn't even dream of, you know, taking into consideration. So that was, I guess, that was, I was going to ask what you sort of, how that fit into here, and whether those in robotics sort of think about this, because at least philosophers at some point have. And then it struck me as well that I think is the problem, and that's sort of what I was trying to push earlier with the toaster, is not so much, I mean, so some philosophers would say, you know, so we have like several values that are like all important. Like Kant, for example, would say something like human dignity / respect for persons, universalizability, that moral norms are sort of universalized fairness, something like this. We might have like, say, you know, 3 to 5 or even like, you know, 20 of these, and we could like program those into a computer. But the problem then is recognizing sort of when they apply and how they apply in sort of real life situations. And interestingly, it's kind of a parallel. Some philosophers, a number of philosophers, are particularists, which basically means that you can sort of only come to know sort of what the right thing to do is in a particular situation. And moral sort of rules or principles aren't, you can't just kind of start with a handful of master principles and, you know, in abstraction kind of analyze the right thing to do. You actually need to be presented with a situation, which is, because I guess the real world is just so complex. Anyway, so that sort of made me think of the toaster, and how the problem there is not so much telling it, you know, what, you know, like, don't harm humans would be one, you know, easy sort of way of, you know, telling it what it should not do, but then the question of how it goes about not harming humans could just be incredibly complex, and that's the part I think that would be hard for a programmer to anticipate. So that's what led me to think of this frame problem, and then to sort of see sort of what those, I guess, in robotics and AI might think of that.
Well, I think the way I can most relate it to the two schools of AI. The first one was rule-based systems, where you would, and absolutely right, the toaster, you'd have to impose some rules. For example, you could have a sensor that quantified the degree of doneness of the bread. And, you know, if it got above a certain degree of doneness, stop. That would be the top rule. It could never be overruled. And for tasks such as making toast, or even indeed playing chess, which is just a very complex form of making toast, if you think about it, they're very well-defined tasks with well-defined outcomes. You know, grandmasters can score, so you've got this game, and that game, white and black like this. If I move my bishop there, that's a, you know, all of us, even basic chess players, that's really a stupid move. Or if I move it there, actually that would be more interesting because you begin to control that bit. So we can quantify the degree of doneness of those, the degree of how well you're doing on this problem. That's the rule-based approach. And, you know, in the 60s, 70s and 80s, everybody thought that's the way that we would get greater and greater intelligence. And rule-based systems, you know, 80 to 90% of computer science departments in the early 80s were working on these problems. There are very few people doing that now because we've discovered that a huge amount of tasks are not captured. And in some ways, the apparently simpler the task is, the harder it is. The way a two-year-old interacts with its environment is actually extremely difficult to capture with a rule-based system. Simple rules like don't burn the toast beyond 45 degrees or a colour that's not light but easy, even chess and complex food, but actually the way a two-year-old interacts with the environment, starts to recognize objects, that is extremely difficult to capture in rules. And that's why the whole learning, that Christoph Koch that I mentioned there, saying the Turing test didn't have an aspect of learning, it actually began with philosophies. You know, a lot of human knowledge is captured through a learning process. And so they started to endow computers with its learning abilities. And in psychology, you have then what's called generalizations. If I've taught you how to recognize faces or how to even write a Bach symphony, then I can give you a completely different starting point, a different picture and so on, and you'll actually do quite well without having any inherent rules for the mathematical construction of Bach piece of music and so on. So it seems that this ability to learn by example and so on is something that is inherent in human beings, which we are beginning to capture with machines. So that's quite interesting, this kind of divide. What are the tasks that rule-based, such as playing, are well captured? What are the tasks through a learning experience are well reproduced by human beings? The big problem is about the learning, is that understanding why the machine comes to this particular answer when new data, new experiments are actually done, etc., when new data is submitted. And we haven't been able to bridge the gap and actually extract. So we can have probabilities for different elements firing, etc., but that doesn't actually tell us how the learning actually takes place. So what is it about these human experiences that rules are very difficult to capture, and yet allowing a human being, or in this case a machine, to see it over and over again gives it the capability of making the right decision. Now, whether we can ever go to higher level abstractions, we can do that quite easy at a low level, building on cameras which duplicate our visual cortex, microphones which duplicate our auditory cortex, and other sensors, and we can do a lot of things that we can do in terms of visual recognition, auditory recognition, and even sense of smell and touch and so on. But when we go to the higher levels of abstraction, in terms of, you know, why I find your question interesting, and the question 6 or 7 ago, so nobody can remember we were 6 or 7, so I'm not going to upset anybody, far less interesting, which is actually quite hard to capture that level of abstraction. That's what people who are pursuing general artificial intelligence believe, that we go to deep learning if we stack these ability to do things at the low level. So we use duplicates of visual cortex to arrive at simple tasks such as face recognition, but now reuse that to do more complex, that we can incrementally arrive at higher levels of abstraction. That's what they hope. It's not proven yet, but it is interesting. What are the representations that exist that might allow you to reach with a machine higher levels of abstraction? It's an open problem. But to me, what is interesting, as somebody who's not a philosopher, so, is that there appears to be different types of tasks. Those that are broken down by rules, and those that are more learned by experience. It'd be interesting in philosophy, to ask philosophers, well, how would you classify these two tasks as being different? What is it that is different about these two tasks that means that the way to solve them by a machine is quite different paradigm? That may be a way of interacting between philosophers and computer scientists. The people who've gone down the learning route hope that by building on the low levels of abstraction, they'll eventually get to higher levels and be able, from the machines, to produce answers to the things that philosophers are concerned about.
We're coming really close to the end of our time. There's one more.
Yeah,
question.
One more is
okay.
Fine.
All right.
I've got more water. Oh, there are two. We'll do
okay,
two.
Let's do two. Yeah,
let's do two.
Been, you've had your hand up for a while. So.
Right. I was wondering, is Dennis Noble's argument, I just wonder if his argument is that we don't understand enough to understand consciousness, therefore AI is not a big threat. Is that his argument?
It's not a question that Dennis Noble addresses in his book. It's more whether we're pre-programmed through genetic determinism.
Right.
So everything that we do is determined by the genetic. Yes, of course, there's some modification from the environment, but fundamentally, you are what your genes tell you to be.
Because to me, in modeling, so I do computational modeling in material science, but in modeling engineering in general, it's about really achieving the objective with the least amount of effort. So, for example, we don't need to understand the individual movement atom to model, you know, materials process.
Yeah.
So about achieving consciousness, to me, is maybe the trick is actually quite simple, just not seeing it. I don't know. So I guess my question is, the real threat of AI, maybe it's just something that it's quite there, we just don't know. So if we're, on one hand, we're building all these computing powers, and if one day someone cracked the trick of consciousness, then that would be the day of our doom, so to speak.
Well, they would have to know, they would have to have their own belief as to what consciousness was and how to program it. And, you know, would it be that person's definition of consciousness, the next person's consciousness, and would it be for good or for bad? Who knows? It would very much, I think, be a mirror image of the creator of that piece of software.
Well, sadly, I'm not a scientist.
There's nothing sad about that.
A few years ago, I was told that silicon had reached its optimum and that they were now developing biological computers, and IBM had been developing one, and they'd written with half a dozen atoms or something. It's the title of the firm, and they had a photograph in the newspaper of this, what they'd done. Is there a qualitative difference, if I'm correct in what I've just been told, is there a qualitative difference between the traditional style of computers and a biological computer, or are they just the same?
Well, it depends how long you've got, or how long we've got.
In principle.
Let me just put this down. The limits of computation with silicon is to do with, eventually, as we keep making what's called the feature size smaller and smaller, and as we pack more and more transistors in 1 square millimeter, there'll come a point where we won't know where the electron is. So how can you know what's going to happen to that particular logic gate if you don't know where the electrons going into it are, where they actually are going into the gate? And interestingly, biology has got the same kind of computation. So there are people building the same building blocks, logic gates, out of biological material. That's what IBM is doing. And one of the interesting things there, which is something we're going to have to solve for electronics as we keep reducing the feature size, it becomes what's called probabilistic computing. You have a probability of the electron actually being there at the input to that gate. And biology does that. Now, there are ways of doing it electronically. You know, you can say the probability of 0.8, you could put a hard threshold on 0.5. So if it's 0.8, we'll call that 1. If it's 0.3 or 0.4, we'll call that 0, because computing is zeros and 1. So you can do simple manipulation on probabilities to arrive at noughts and ones. And it's effectively what happens in the biology, because your neurons are constantly firing there as I stimulate them with this very interesting answer. But at the level of what's happening in terms of the synaptic currents and so on, there's Bill and our chemist friends will probably be able to say it's much better than me. Through the synaptic transmitters, there's build-up of ionic currents, and eventually there's a probability, it's all or nothing, we're far, we won't far. And the amount that's needed to make it far is not always exactly the same. There's what we call noise in the system. So it's probabilistic. When you get sufficient amount of chemical, then the probability of it far increases, but it's only a probability. It's not absolutely 100% sure that it will fire. And once it fires, then it actually fire or doesn't. So it's yes, it fires, it's a 1, doesn't fire, it's a 0. And so this ability to transform something which is probabilistic to a yes or no, to a binary, is something we're very interested in computing, because we are being forced to think about exactly that with our own circuits. And therefore, there's interest in doing that biologically, and also the ability to connect things up biologically and to compute has got some interesting properties that you don't have in silicon. So there's a great drive, although it's a side interest, and there are completely different answers, including Oxford looking at quantum computing, which is yet a different way of doing it. So some people are looking at the biology, some people are looking at, as we make things small in silicon, how do we deal with the fact we're going to have probabilities rather than ones and nought, and some people are looking to see what we're learning from biology at its very low level of translating probabilities into a binary code of 0 and 1. And the probability that the answer was satisfactory is probably about 0.6. Certainly not 1.
All right.
Good. Well, thank you for an excellent lecture and your generosity of time with answering questions. So let's thank Professor